The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to John Barber's World Live. This is John Barber, and that was a very bad impression of Bela Lugosi, the great actor forever famous as Dracula, a face that is seen every Halloween almost as much as the pumpkin. I hope you're all having fun getting ready for whatever celebration you're off to. Me, I'll be reading a bunch of the CIA JFK files. A number of you sent me, and so thank you for that. For Trump and the CIA, Halloween is the perfect time for tricks and expect no treats. Anyone who expects anything significant from these files is an idiot. The most incriminating files are already in the American media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which more than any other film or book shows how simple it is to force the government to pursue a still open case. The problem is not the government. The problem is the so-called leaders of the assassination community, of which I'm not a member, which is so preoccupied with their own egos and undertakings that they cannot pull their heads out of their asses for a moment to join forces as one and march on the Justice Department every November 22nd, which should be our Bastille Day, and demand action. What limited action I can do as an individual is as follows. I'll be speaking at the Press Club in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday the 14th. The following day, a free screening at American University, where in June 1963, President John Kennedy gave his most famous peace speech. Another free screening will be announced shortly thereafter with a national press release. To both, I will invite members of Congress. I've already written my representative, Dina Titus, and you can see that invitation up on YouTube. Sunday, next Sunday, the 5th, I'll be in Vancouver, British Columbia, at Leno Sanek's Fiasco Brothers Studios at a small private screening with a live free YouTube Q&A to follow, which you can get by subscribing to Len's free Black Op channel. I mentioned the other day that the CIA is continuing to lie about the murdering of John Kennedy, releasing the files during Halloween. Reminds me of the wife who catches her husband in bed screwing another woman, and the guy hollers, "Honey, this is not me." And the wife stays with him. The media in America is sadly that accepting wife. When I mentioned this, I got a barrage of very funny, profound comments from my Facebook friends who are much funnier than I am. One, Carolina Lynn, said, quote, "The USA went to a Halloween party dressed as a democracy," unquote. That is beyond brilliant. That's Mark Twainish. And Sadie May said, quote, "Nightmare on Elm Street," unquote. And that is dead on. I have some absolutely great Facebook friends and absolutely great guests, especially tonight. The son of the highly respected actor who years ago scared me and millions forever with his iconic portrayal of Count Dracula. Tonight, his highly respected, successful son, continuing in the horror business as a lawyer, Bela Lugosi Jr. Bela, welcome to the show. And I'm sorry for that, but it just slipped out. How are you and where are you?
Okay, Bob, I'm in Los Angeles, California, and I'm okay. Thanks for asking.
Well, thank you again so much for being here. I have a number of important questions that I want to ask you. And I don't know whether first to start with the very famous legendary lawsuit that you brought against Universal to protect your father's image, or your impressions of horror films today. And I think I'll start with the latter, because when I was a youngster and I saw your father and Boris Karloff and those early movies, all of which scared me to death, and I still have memories of them, they were two fright films. But somehow or other, all this has changed from fright to gore, like films like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Do you have some observations that you would like to make about the change?
Well, you know, these are almost like they're separate genres, even though they're referred to in the rubric horror. In the early 30s, when my father played Dracula, first on the stage, then in the film, it started a wave of iconic figures, part of pop culture today. With my dad in particular, since he wasn't made up as some kind of a monster, he was Count Dracula, and Count Dracula is Bela Lugosi. Now, years later, horror pictures have evolved into the gore that you have referred to. But that's a whole different kind of horror. It's more subliminal.
The blood and gore that you see today is almost repulsive, but when your father portrayed Count Dracula, the fear that we would feel as an audience grew in our imagination and before our eyes. We were never repulsed by what we saw. We were either frightened or we were fascinated. And tell us a little bit about the background of your father, Bela, because evidently he was a highly respected and esteemed Broadway actor and European actor. Tell us a little bit about your father's background.
Well, in Hungary, where he was born, he, at an early age, went into the theater and eventually rose to the National Theater in Hungary, playing all the classic parts on stage, and then went to Germany, and he was in silent films in Hungary and in Germany. He came to the United States. He was a stage actor and a film actor, and it wasn't until 1931 that he appeared, when he was age 49, as the character Dracula. And he defined that character for all time, as it turns out.
Well, evidently he did. So then I have this extra question to ask about your father. At a time when he was old enough to talk to you about what happened to him when he was 49 years of age, he became more famous than the President of the United States or the King or Queen of England as this character. Now, probably, I want to know how he felt about that and how he felt about the fact that for perhaps the rest of his career, it's like when Tony Perkins was in Psycho, and I was in the mailroom at the time when Tony Perkins was making Friendly Persuasions and other films, and he was a pretty decent actor. And of course, when he played that terrific Psycho in Psycho, he had to leave America to go to Europe to get other parts, and he forever hated having played that part. What was your father's reaction to that success and the fact that he was literally locked in there?
Like he said before in interviews, Dracula never dies. And he acknowledged that in a way it was a blessing and in a way it was a curse. It kept him on the screen doing parts in the one hand, and on the other hand, it typecast him and tied his hands, and that was a big regret of his because he liked to do all variety of parts. He played Jesus Christ. He played a Mohawk Indian, a gypsy, Igor, the broken neck grave robber, the zombie master in the first zombie movie in 1932.
My goodness. Bella, yourself, how old were you when you realized that your father was a successful star and actor and this character, Count Dracula?
Probably when I started grammar school, first grade, people would know who my dad was, whereas they didn't know who the dads were of the other kids in school. They certainly knew that something was different about me. And
did they in any way tease you or bully you or do these dreadful impressions like I do?
No, I just got their attention. And, you know, when you're a kid, you like to blend in with the lockers. You don't like attention. But
yes.
After I was through high school and into college, I actually have become more cognizant and more proud of the mark that he has made and the adversities he's overcome.
Do you have a sister?
No.
Are you the only child?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So, as the only child, what was the experience like in your household with just your mother and your father when he was not at work? Do you have happy memories? Do you have some disturbing memories?
No, I have good memories. He was a good dad. He really, cared for me, tried to teach me. He was 56 years old when I was born.
Oh, my goodness.
And so by the time I was teachable, there was quite an age gap there.
You sound like Humphrey Bogart's son, 56 when you were born. Because I was working once at a place called General Film Laboratories in Hollywood just before I went to work in mailroom at Paramount Studios. And I ran into your father there, and he said hello. He had a nice entourage around him. He was extremely gentlemanly, extremely polite. And I was staggered. I just stared at your father.
Well, you know, and that's a consistent impression that people that have met him relate to me. I hear that all the time.
And you know, as a result of that, you know, I ended up, of course, as you may or may not know, as a film critic in Los Angeles Magazine for 10 years and then 5 years at NBC with Tom Snyder and Jess Marlowe on the news. So I read everything about actors. And of course, once I got into the business, and I was this lonely kid in Toronto going into this Manor Theater, and then I'd go in there and see your father in these movies and Boris Karloff. I mean, I love to be scared, so I'd keep going back to them. So I read all about them. And I need to ask you a couple of questions, and I don't wish to embarrass me, and you tell me to stop if you need me to stop. I read a number of stories about the fact that your father, as the case with a lot of A-type personalities, even though they're quiet and gentle, they are highly sexually active, and that he had an intense interest in women. And the other thing is that he may have experimented with drugs at one point or another in his life.
These are areas that, don't forget, I think 18 when he died. These aren't the kind of things that enter the head of someone that young.
Ah, yes, I see. I see. So did you learn something more about your father that you did not know after your father died? You're 18 years of age and your father dies. Okay, first of all, what is the experience like for you, Bella, as an 18-year-old, which you probably start in college or something, and your mother with the passing of your father?
Well,
was it tough? Did he leave you? Because Jerry Lewis just died and didn't leave his sons anything. I mean, yeah. Did your father leave you and your mother any kind of small estate?
Well, my dad and mom were not married to each other when my dad died. He had remarried. He and my mom had gotten a divorce after 20 years.
Oh, wow.
He had married another lady. And whatever estate there was given to us.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. That did you like what, if this woman became your stepmother, did you like her at all?
Well, I'm not going to get into that kind of a thing.
Okay, I'm sorry. Was she an actress, this woman?
No, I think actually she had been a nurse, but I'm not, or a secretary.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, then I don't want to go that into that any further. But back to the question about, obviously now you've become a little old. When did you decide that you were going to become a lawyer, and why did you make that decision?
Well, I was in college. I hadn't chosen a path by the time my dad died, so he never knew. But he always counseled me that I shouldn't stay out of the talent side of the entertainment business because you're too dependent upon producers and agents. And so when I was in college, I was getting near the end of my undergraduate, and I hadn't chosen a path. And so I was at USC at the business school, so I took the LSAT and the GMAC, which is, you know, the graduate business test and the law school test, and decided that whichever I did the better in, that's the way, the direction I'd go. It turned out I did better in the law school aptitude test and went to law school, and I've never regretted it.
Well, I guess there are a number of people who are famous today who have to thank you for taking that test and going to law school. As you well know, and maybe a lot of people do not know, I mean, Albert Einstein has been dead for decades, okay? And Elvis Presley has been dead for decades, as has your father. And yet their estates benefit almost as much financially from the images that are sold representing these famous people as when they were alive. You brought a very famous suit against Universal Studios. Tell me what prompted that suit, what the suit is about, and where it stands today.
In 1963, I was still in law school, and one of my classmates brought to my attention a plastic model kit. And the box that the kit was in had graphics on it, and including images of my dad. And I started investigating and found that there was a whole bunch of other products that Universal had licensed, and they were purporting to license Dracula, but the photographs they gave the licensees was my dad, not anybody else who had played Dracula. So they were trading on Dracula's, on my father's persona. And so I brought a lawsuit. I was represented by the intellectual property professor at USC Law School against Universal in 1963. And that case wound its way through the courts for, you know, 13 or 15 years. It wasn't until 1979.
That my goodness.
The Supreme Court decision became final on the merits. In that case, I had originally won in the trial court. And so there was many years between then and a further proceedings to determine the amount of damages. During that interim, you know, since California is the leader in that, you know, entertainment industry, the decision at the trial court was really adopted throughout the country by, you know, in other states. But anyway, ultimately, the Supreme Court reversed and ruled on the critical issue in the case, which was the right of publicity of a deceased person survive his death and pass on to the heirs. The Supreme Court said, no, it does not. Your right to the commercial exploitation of the likeness is a personal right and dies with the person. So after that case came down, I and other heirs of celebrities approached the lawmakers in Sacramento to enact what became known as the Celebrity Rights Act to reverse the Supreme Court decision, which
how wonderful. You reversed the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and so from that time on, it's been the law of the land in California here, and then it spread, you know, throughout the United States.
So now, Bella, if there are images of your father used somewhere for commercial purposes, there has to be some kind of royalty paid to you.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. That is so, so wonderful and good for you. I think that is just fantastic. I mean, it is so important. I mean, your father would be so enormously proud of you. I mean, my goodness.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that because at the end of his life, in those years, he thought nobody remembered him. And so he'd be amazed today.
Oh, my goodness.
He's more well-known than he ever was.
Now, tell me about your family. Are you married and do you have children?
I'm married. I have four children, and I have seven grandchildren.
Okay, tell me mainly about the four children. How old are they, and what do they do?
The oldest one was born in 1959, and he's a fixed income manager in the financial industry.
Good.
My next son was a year younger than that, and he's an expert in real estate.
Wow, good for him.
And a consultant to developers and resort owners. And then my daughter, Lynn, she and I work together every day, keeping the image of Dad alive, doing all the merchandising deals.
How wonderful. Good for you.
So we have a real nice situation going.
My
fourth child, son, is a computer expert. He works on, you know, hardware and software issues.
Well, that is fantastic. First of all, your son will never be out of work in this. Your fourth son will never be out of work, or your third son, rather, will never be out of work in this day and age. And with all that you and Lynn have to do in preserving your father's image in the merchandising, you're going to have the technical expertise of your son to do that. Now, they must be not only enormously proud of you because of what you did in saving their grandfather's image, you just must feel wonderful about your family and then, of course, your grandchildren. Now, when you were older and you met people with, did you ever meet Boris Karloff after your father died?
Not that I remember.
Okay.
I was told that I was at the, you know, at the same place that he was, and from time to time. And I have seen one picture where I'm standing there next to him, but I have no recollection of him.
Now, one of course, the most famous things in the world about your father, aside from the fact that he was darkly handsome and he was just brilliant as this character, is that cape he wore as Count Dracula. Where is that cape? I mean, I know Debbie Reynolds used to made a fortune eventually selling all the Hollywood dresses that she had gathered. Where is that cape today, Bella?
Well, we have a lot of memorabilia from my dad, and you know, it has to be preserved in a particular way, which we do, and so. Yeah, I'm not
going to
go beyond that.
Okay, because I would just imagine that cape must be worth an absolute fortune, and I'm sure you've gotten a number of offers for it. Now, when you were talking about the merchandising, I know nothing about that, but there must be all kinds of conferences and conventions around America or around the world revolving around famous characters like your father in horror movies. Do you attend these things?
I do from time to time. I do, you know, 3 or 4 a year, and it's the most wonderful experience. We have people coming up saying the nicest things, getting their picture taken with me, and getting things signed if they want it.
Well, that is absolutely wonderful. That's so long after your father's death, he still brings pleasure to people. I mean, not only on the screen, but when you go around and doing these sort of things. What do you think is the most interesting thing you ever learned about your father after the age of 18, when your father was gone?
How active he was in so many areas of life. He could converse a little bit in a number of languages because of his travels. He was a voracious reader in all sorts of subjects. He loved to party. his friends were musicians and actors and people in the Hungarian community. And
did anyone in your family, I mean, your father said, you know, don't get into the performing end of it, which is very, very true, because then your fate is in somebody else's hands. You don't like the color of your eyes, or you're only 5'10" and they want you to be 5'2" or 7'1". So that is very, very smart. But now you have grandchildren. Are some of your grandchildren interested in getting into the performing arts in any way?
Musicians,
actors?
Yep.
Well,
I've got two.
Okay, Bella, since you're the son who was talked out of it, are you going to be the grandfather that's going to talk them into it and support them?
No, yeah, I never dealt with my children that way. They make their own decisions. We don't push them.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. Bella, I want to thank you so, so much for being on the show. And I'll tell you, I was only 16 years of age when I met your father at the film laboratory in Los Angeles, and remember how nice he was to me, this runaway kid from Canada. I want to thank you so much, by the way.
I really appreciate that. Thanks for expressing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. I must tell you, your father still has millions of fans and many more so thanks to you. God bless you and your family. And I hope we get a chance to talk again And you have a great Halloween tomorrow.
Thank you, and good evening.
Good evening. We'll be right back with the irreplaceable and irrepressible Joe Satilli with more tricks and treats from the White House. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you. That smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World Live on Halloween Eve. I am so moved and impressed first by my interview with Bela Lugosi Jr. and what he did for the father and other celebrities' children to save the images financially of their parents. But I'm really delighted to again be here with Joe Satilli, my cohort, his news vandal today. It's a grab bag of tricks and treats. I'm telling you, if you get it, there's any article that you can read is so informative. Joe, welcome to the show. So you take over now and tell us all about these tricks and treats on Halloween Eve that are coming out of Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, I want to get to what I think was just a pitiful rope-a-dope over the JFK files and get your thoughts on that what happened last week. Today was, everybody knows the Manafort indictment. Everybody's paying attention to the Manafort indictment, but the Manafort indictment is kind of the shiny object. It's not, it's a distraction from what really was rooted in the Papadopoulos plea bargain. He was arrested in August. He struck a plea deal.
What was he arrested for?
For lying to the FBI under oath, apparently, or at least lying when he was being examined, when he was being deposed. So that was the initial thing. That's really the only thing so far, the only crime we can find that he has committed is that he was lying. But he was lying. He said he knew this it reads like a really bad sort of potboiler spy novel. There's the professor, not Marianne, unfortunately, because I was always a big Marianne fan, but there's the professor, and then there's a woman posing as Putin's niece, who I'm wondering if that's Veselnitskaya, the woman who met with Donnie Jr. in Trump Tower, said that she had dirt on Clinton. See, because the real nub here is this, is that this guy, George Papadopoulos, who was one of five people on Trump's Foreign Policy Advisory Council, and he mentioned him in a Washington Post interview, and there's a picture of him at a meeting with Trump. And this is a guy who on his resume, a 30-year-old guy, put one of his credentials as part down as he participated in a mock UN, which is, I guess, enough to become an advisor to the then candidate Donald Trump. So this guy who had, you know, who had been, I guess, the ambassador from Oman in a mock UN or something, but he said he met this woman before he joined the campaign and met the professor before he had not. He lied about the fact that this woman had offered him dirt on Hillary Clinton, including thousands of emails.
Wow.
And this came in April of 26th of last year, about 3 weeks after it is believed that Podesta's emails were pilfered from the DNC.
Wow.
So this is – now, I know – there are a lot of ideas, whether it's, you know, there's still, I'm sure, the Seth Rich people, and they think that maybe it was actually spirited out as it was a leak from a DNC insider who was upset about the treatment of Bernie Sanders, and then it made its way to WikiLeaks. Well, here we have something that is pretty solid, a guy saying, no, a Russian official, connected official came to me and said, we have thousands of emails and dirt on Hillary Clinton. Are you interested? He then reported back to three people in the campaign. We now know who two of them are already. One of them was Manafort. Another one is one of my all-time favorites, John, a guy named Sam Clovis, a 300-pound man who was a right-wing talk radio host in Iowa, who became co-chair of Trump's campaign. And he is famous for a blog in which he called white people race traitors and called black people who dealt with white people on behalf of Black Lives Matter race traitors with a D. Apparently people who are...
Is this guy Clovis black?
No, he's basically a racist white guy. He's a white nationalist who has made it into Trump's campaign. And then he has no scientific credentials whatsoever, but he was nominated to the top science post in the USDA. Well, that hearing has finally been scheduled, I think, in the last few days, and it's scheduled for next week. Well, guess what's going to happen at the hearing now that it's turned out that he is one of the guys that Papadopoulos was reporting back to and saying, hey, the Russians want to meet Trump. What should we do? Well, maybe you should go, because it's all here in the plea bargain. He tells the whole story that they kept these Russian cutouts basically kept coming to him and saying Putin wants to meet with Trump. We want you to come to the foreign ministry. We want Trump to come to the foreign ministry. We want to help give you dirt. We want to give you these thousands of emails. And he kept going back to Manafort and Clovis and one other unnamed individual or unidentified individual. And they kept saying, yes, keep doing it, but we got to keep it low level. You need to do it. We can't expose Donald Trump to this, because we need to have, you know, basically plausible deniability. So it's all there in the plea. So this is some really, really troublesome stuff. And then there is now speculation that he may have been wearing a wire, because he was arrested in August. And there's a very interesting August 14th Washington Post story in which the Post is giving details that they should not have known and only would have known perhaps if Papadopoulos had a wire put on him by the FBI and was calling people in the Trump White House who were in the campaign and saying, the FBI got me, what should I do? And maybe got them on record saying, oh, say these things and deny everything, which could be – this is why I think this plea bargain being revealed today is so important, because I think Mueller is saying, okay, folks, this is what we know. You all know this Papadopoulos guy. You know these three unnamed officials. We now have two names, Manafort and Clovis. And you know all these things that we've laid out here in his plea and all the things he's admitted to. Time for you to either lawyer up or come forward to us and tell us what you know, because we basically have the goods on a number of you. And so this is a classic squeeze tactic that a prosecutor will use. And it probably explains why over the last week, Donald Trump and the and Fox News and others have been trying to make the case that the real collusion with Russia was on the part of Hillary Clinton and the DNC, which is literally what they're saying. And look, I know the Uranium One thing. I've written about it. I put it into a story in which I was heavily critical of Hillary Clinton about her free, about her approach to free trade, her backtracking on free trade, which I wrote 2 months before the election on Consortium News. This, there's this Uranium One deal in which Russia bought 20% of America's uranium. They cannot ship it overseas. It's all being sold inside the United States. And this was during the time of the Russia pivot. There's a one of the, you know, smarmy Clinton things that happens with these deals is that Bill Clinton suddenly got a speaking engagement for $500,000 in Russia when this went through. So there's thought that there's a quid pro quo, but Hillary State Department was one of nine agencies that had to sign off. So that's only one of nine. She could not get it through on her own or the State Department on their own, but it's still a smarmy Clinton deal. I mean, this is the thing about the Clintons. They cut corners and do smarmy deals, but they just have a way of making everything just barely legal enough for you to never get them, right? So,
yeah,
I mean that's the way that goes. But they're also making the case now that she has been colluding with Russia, which I think is one of the funniest things, because what the logic of that is that Hillary Clinton was colluding with the Russians to defeat herself, which tells you the level of the desperation on the part of this machinery that, that Trump and Fox News have going to try and obfuscate what is obviously some very, very bad news.
Wow. Well, you know, the astonishing thing to me is the it seems the excellent investigation that the FBI is conducting against Trump and in this case reveals a kind of a Jekyll and Hyde personality about the FBI, because living here in Vegas, I have seen Sheriff Lombardo unraveling under my very eyes each time he got up for a press conference, and especially after he said that Paddock had to have help. He couldn't have done this alone. And the FBI has taken over, and they are deliberately obscuring the timelines and the bungling. They're not producing any video of Paddock at any point. I mean, they've wiped clean, the FBI wiped clean the thousands of cell phones that people gave them when they asked them for help in identifying what was going on. And then I had a retired police officer in New Orleans send me videos of the 10 worst crimes committed by the FBI. And included mainly in that was the attempt by J. Edgar Hoover to get Martin Luther King to kill himself. Right. And when that wasn't successful, they set him up at the Lorraine Motel. That was the FBI that did that. So they helped set up his murder because Hoover called him the most dangerous man in America. And in a courtroom, the FBI has proven to be the murderers of Black Panthers in Chicago. And also the first attack on the Trade Center in New York City is set up by the FBI. The guy who thought he had fake bombs, and the FBI gave him real bombs. And last week, as you know, Julian Assange said about Vegas, it's FBI because they need funding to fight terrorists. If there are no real terrorists, they create them on their own. So on the one hand, you have that Jekyll. And then on the other hand, you have this really perfectly thought out investigation against Trump. Why do you think they are so effective against what in pursuing what it is they're doing now? And it looks like in that case, they're doing an excellent job as law enforcement officers.
Well, no, I think you make some excellent points. I mean, here's the thing about Bob Mueller, because this is actually beyond an FBI investigation. He's marshaling FBI assets, no doubt. We know that. But he also has assembled a team of some of the really some of the best financial crimes investigators on the planet. And, you know, I have a I think I've mentioned it on the show here with you. I do have a theory that what we are seeing is an internecine war between two systems of money laundering. The traditional Western money laundering that comes out of Britain and the, you know, the Netherlands Antilles and the United States and goes in through Central America, Panama, and the Caribbean, and the new nouveau riche folks who are involved in money laundering.
Would the nouveau riche include Trump?
No, well, yes, because the nouveau riche would be the gangster money launderers that have come out of Eastern Europe and Russia. And so you have these two competing forces.
Oh, and how interesting.
The Russian forces have really, they were the ones to really hone in on using real estate deals for money laundering. And what did Manafort get in trouble for today? $18 million worth of money laundering, a lot of it through real estate, where you buy a piece of real estate and then you leverage that real estate with loans. And it's a way of basically getting tax-free money into your hands by taking loans out against real estate that's been leveraged off of money that's been laundered.
Oh, and my goodness.
So this is how, I mean, the Russians have been doing it. Russian mobsters and the Russian oligarchs around Putin have been doing it for years. And one of the guys who needed money because no banks would give him money because he had so many failed ventures by the turn of the century was one Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And so Donald Trump, and this is why Trump Soho is sort of ground zero. And Trump Soho is a place where Donnie Jr. and Ivanka are exposed on fraud in selling some of these properties that in this tower that was built there, this luxury condo project that Donald Trump was touting on The Apprentice. And it's, you know, I have a good source, and I've been pointed all along the way to these things by this very good source. And this very good source said, you know, look at Trump Soho. That's where the rubber meets the road. It's on money laundering. When Manafort came on, I was told all about Manafort. And another name came up that finally came up in a story today about Tom Barrack. Tom Barrack is the guy who is now being blamed for bringing Manafort and Gates, his underling, who is also charged as a co-conspirator today. He's now being blamed inside the West Wing as of like 5 o'clock this afternoon. Reporting is saying, and I know from my source that Tom Barrack is himself a money launderer who is reputed to have been a big money launderer for the Saudis.
Okay, and so let me ask you a couple of questions then, because two of the leading financial leeches in American history of its presidents were, first of all, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
I mean, by far the worst, okay? What if it is true that Donald Trump was and maybe is a major money launderer? That's the president of the United States. We never were allowed to uncover that with Richard Nixon because he resigned. And then, of course, Lyndon Johnson quit running for the presidency. So we never got into that, even though he was charged posthumously in Texas with complicity to commit murder. Couple of murders. Now, if they find out that is true about this president, do you think they will ever allow that truth to be known to the public at large by bringing charges of impeachment or whatever against Donald Trump? Because it shows, if they do that, that the entire system is corrupt.
This is, I think, one of the dangerous games. You know, you brought up the thing about the FBI. I was going to say that Bob Mueller, I have it on good authority that at one point during the BCCI scandal, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which is one of the greatest scandals in American history that nobody knows about. I mean, this is, if you want to talk about funding for early Al-Qaeda and in Pakistani banks and all of the people in the particularly in the Republican Party, but it also took down the Democratic Party. That's what took down Clark Clifford. And Altman, remember Linda Carter's wife, Altman, they got taken down. A lot of people got taken down. And I know I'm sure it's a fact because my source is strong, is that Bob Mueller let Paul Manafort walk away from that when he could have taken him down, because Manafort was involved in the money laundering there. So this is as you say, this is a deep system. And now Mueller, you know, how much did he really stand up when the Bush administration was running wild on torture when he was at the FBI? Not a lot. So the FBI is compromised. But I also have it on good authority that there still is an internecine war, another internecine war between the CIA and the FBI, and that there are people in the FBI who believe they're the only remaining check on the power of the CIA. And I do think it's interesting that the CIA is now fully under control, at least at the top level, at least policy-wise, by Donald Trump's guy, Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo is a Trump guy. He's got his guy there. And so I'm wondering how much of what we're seeing are the echoes or the reverberations of a larger war in which the FBI is trying to curtail the CIA and the CIA is trying to wrest itself from the FBI. This is the thing, John. We only get hints and echoes and flavors of these things because there still is a great deal of secrecy, as we found last week, when I believe Trump played all of his supporters and played everybody for a fool with the JFK files. I don't know how many of those files you looked at. I looked at some of them. It's garbage. There's nothing there, right?
Yeah, there was one release that said Hitler was alive and died when he was 104. So, right. I mean,
don't you feel like we were basically being trolled? We were being rope-a-doped. And what Donald Trump got was a whole week of distraction, got to feel like he's some enemy of the deep state. He's not an enemy of the deep state. He's on one side of one part of what's a large scrum of deep staters. And it's, you know, they're having.
Well, I must tell you that the files are the aluminum siding that they're putting over the outhouse of this outlaw government. Yeah. We've had an outlaw government since they murdered John Kennedy in 1963. So while I have seen I smile at most of the files, but I'm glad there is a furor about it, because of that furor, I am going to get a chance to have two extremely noteworthy screenings in Washington, D.C. within the next 3 weeks, to which I'm going to invite Congress members or members of their staff. Now, I don't care if they don't even show up, and I doubt that many will show up. I've already written to Congresswoman Dina Titus, I'm one of her constituents, and you can see that invitation on YouTube. It doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter if only 200 people see the film. What will happen is I have one of the top ad agency execs in America with major clients who is a fan of the film and a fan of ours, who is going to put out a national press release. And she said, it doesn't matter that 100 or 200 people will see your film, John. She said 250,000 people will read the press release and they'll finally know about your movie.
That's right. Yeah, it's perfect timing, because in many ways it kind of cuts right to the quick of proving exactly what it is you were talking about in the film.
And you know what? This irony just occurs to me. Everybody should see the film in order to realize what a monster America has become, and how it could be salvaged by probably opening this case and going after some of the people still alive who participated in the murder or the cover-up of the murder of John Kennedy. The audience will learn how corrupt their government is, how corrupt their media is, but you know what? They will discover a truth that is a lot more easy to digest than the truth of what's happening in Washington, D.C. now that you have been telling us about, with all this money laundering.
Well, that's very true. I know we're out of time, John, and I can't wait to hear about the showings at American University in Washington, D.C., if they're going to be at American, at least in D.C. And thank you for having me on this week, and I look forward to talking to you in 2 weeks.
Well, Joe, it's an absolute thrill for me every week to have you. It's a thrill every day to read your stuff. You have a wonderful Halloween. Everyone out there, have a great Halloween. And as Ed Murrow used to say, good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.